This is Fresh Air. William Safire is back with us to talk about speechwriting and political rhetoric. He was a speechwriter for President Richard Nixon and Vice President Spiro Agnew. Now Safire writes the On Language column for the New York Times Magazine. He also writes a syndicated political column. I want to talk to you about speeches of this campaign as a former speechwriter yourself and as the editor of a new book of speeches in history. First of all, we see some of George Bush's lines are coming back to haunt him, like "read my lips" and "kinder and gentler nation." Is this a typical problem with speeches, that some of the lines that stand out the most can be turned against you if things go sour?
Oh, sure. Nixon, in a press conference, said, look, I'm not a crook, when accused of some venality or some stealing money. Well, he wasn't stealing money, and he wasn't a crook. So, yes, effective lines, strongly delivered and well-believed lines, often come and clobber you. "Read My Lips," for example, is now slamming back at George Bush. It was an excellent rhetorical device by Peggy Noonan, who's a superb speechwriter. And quite frankly, it's a pity that both Peggy and particularly Ray Price, who was one of my associates in the Nixon era, who was a specialist in uplift and idealism. It's a pity that he wasn't permitted to finish the speech of George Bush at the acceptance in the Houston Convention this year.
What did you think of Bush's speech?
Terrible. I thought it was an hour long, which is a good 20 minutes too long. And I thought it was kind of a rehash of the State of the Union, which never went anywhere anyway. And it wasn't thematic, and it wasn't open-armed. It didn't say, come on in, and here's how we'll be different next year. He talked about identifying himself with Harry Truman, and there's something phony about that. He's not Harry Truman.
When George Bush accuses Bill Clinton of waffling, and Bush says, we're not going to turn the White House into the Waffle House, is that effective or is that adolescent?
I think a more effective one was trickle-down. You heard the
trickle-down government?
Well, trickle-down economics is all you've been hearing from Clinton. And the curious thing is that, rhetorically, you can't put a nomics suffix on a person whose name doesn't end with an N. You know, you can talk about Reaganomics, you can talk about Nixonomics, but you can't talk about Carteromics or Bushomics or Bushnomics. So you have to get another characterization. Of course, you will be able to talk about Clintonomics if it comes to pass. So you have to have another characterization. So he reached back to the 1930s and talked about the trickle-down theory, which most people don't really remember too well, but it has something to do with helping the rich so that ultimately the poor get helped. So he was jamming away at trickle-down economics, and the Republicans were taking it on the chin for that. And then finally somebody came up with, well, why don't we zap back with trickle-down government? And that's what the Democrats are trying to sell. So that was a nice comeback.
Now, you were a speechwriter in the Nixon-Agnew administration. Your most famous line was for Agnew when he was attacking the press. And the line was the nattering nabobs of negativism.
Now, no, he wasn't attacking the press in that speech.
Wasn't he attacking the press?
Pat Buchanan wrote a ring-a-ding speech for him in Des Moines in which he zapped the press and talked about instant analysis and indeed changed press coverage of politics for a generation as a result. I did a speech out in San Diego about the nattering nabobs of negativism, which was against pessimists. And I took my text from Adlai Stevenson, who was against the prophets of doom and gloom.
Do you think nattering nabobs of negativism is a bit too much on the alliteration?
Well, I kind of liked it, I tell you the truth. I gave him another one, the hysterical hypochondriacs of history. And
wait, wasn't it the hopeless hysterical?
Yes, right. There was a fourth H in there.
Yeah.
But we didn't use it because of the 4-H clubs, so we didn't. We thought they would not like it. But alliteration was sort of thrust into the American consciousness by Warren G. Harding, who talked about not nostrums but normalcy, not experiment, but equipoise, and he went on for about 10 more alliterations.
So you didn't think there were too many ends in that?
Well, it seems to have lasted.
I mean, right.
If you only had two, I don't think it would have gone. For example, Pat Buchanan came up with pusillanimous pussyfooters, and that never went. I think it needed a third P.
I think maybe it was too hard to pronounce.
Could be, too.
Well, of all the lines that you've written for, you know, in speeches, do you have favorites that stand out in your mind? Ones that you're particularly proud of?
You're asking me to break the code. You
can't,
the code.
What? Explain the code.
The code is unless the principal specifically cites your work as coming from you, then you stand there and say, I worked with so-and-so on that speech, and it's his speech or her speech.
And what is the function of that code?
That's the law of the speechwriters. And the function of it is the speechwriter should not get the credit for the speech, because after all, although a writer might create the words, they are accepted or rejected by the person responsible for them. And so I think when a speechwriter today gets the focus placed on him or her, it somewhat demeans the speaker.
Is the other function of the code so that the politician isn't embarrassed when voters think, well, he didn't write that anyways, this is a great line, but it was really the speechwriter who came up with it. We can't really give you, the politician, any credit for it.
Where in most cases, in most political speeches, it's a give and take between the writer and the politician. I used to do that with Nixon, I remember. I would go in there and sit down, and he would say, these are the points I want to make. And I would give him a draft, and he would say, you know, you had a great opening and a pretty good close, but the middle is terrible. And I would redo it and give it back to him, and he'd say, I like this line, and whatever happened to that line we used in the speech 2 years ago, and he'd bring that back. And it's a collaboration, and that, I think, is the best kind of speech writing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is political columnist William Safire. He has two new books. One is called The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. And the other is a collection of great speeches in history that Safire edited, and it's called Lend Me Your Ears. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is syndicated columnist William Safire. He has two new books. One is called The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. And the other is an anthology of great speeches in history that he edited. It's called Lend Me Your Ears. Do you think rhetoric, political rhetoric, is changing now? Do you think it's become more dependent on kind of TV conversationality, you know, conversational quality as opposed to speech-making quality?
The grand speech made at a convention, you don't see too much of. Ronald Reagan was a good speechmaker, but he didn't make the grand oratory. He spoke directly to people on television. The decision you make in a convention is, do you talk to the hall and have the viewer at home feel like part of a vast audience, or do you use the convention as a prop and speak directly into the camera and speak to the viewer as an individual? There's an argument to be made for both, and depending on what you're good at. Ted Kennedy, for example, is very good in a hall and terrible speaking directly to the viewer.
In your book about Job, you write, I started my journey with doubt in my faith and have come out with faith in my doubt. And then you kind of parenthetically say, that's a great speechwriter's trick, you know, to...
That's the turnaround line.
The turnaround, right. Mm-hmm. Right. What are some of the other great speechwriter tricks?
Well, the most famous one along those lines is let us not fear to negotiate, but let us not negotiate out of fear. Kennedy used to use those contrabuntal, or Ted Sorensen used to suggest them fairly frequently, and so did Churchill. The tricks, the anaphora, the repetition of a particular phrase or line, the beginning of let us, Lincoln used let us do this, let us do that, and everybody else since then has been using it. There are various oratorical tricks, but frankly, the tricks are not what make a speech. It's first, what do I have to say, and how can I move people with this?
You worked as a speechwriter with the Nixon administration. I think it was after you left that you found out about Watergate. after you left the administration, you found out your own home and office phones had been tapped. When you found out that your phones had been tapped, did that change your mind about Nixon, about the party, about politics in general?
It sure got me angry. I was always a big believer in privacy, and I'm a libertarian. I think government should butt out of people's lives as much as possible. And so when I learned that I was being tapped, and I was an old loyalist from way back, and I was being tapped by a bunch of Johnny's come lately, the plural of Johnny come lately is Johnny's come lately. I objected strenuously, and it did diminish my respect for the Nixon team, but I remained a Nixon loyalist anyway.
Why?
Well, I'd had a lot of equity in there, and I respected Nixon for a lot of the things that he did.
But somebody in the administration obviously didn't respect you if they were tapping your phone.
Right, and I had to... fairly severe reaction there, and I zapped him. And at that point, I was a pundit for the New York Times, and I blazed away at him.
You thought it was Kissinger?
I thought it was Al Haig and Kissinger and John Mitchell.
And why do you think your phone was being tapped?
Oh, I was consorting with known journalists. And
were you leaking things to them?
Well, as a matter of fact, I remember what occasioned it all. I was working on a welfare reform speech, the speech known as Nixon's Good Deed, where he actually came up with a wonderful program that George Shultz and Pat Moynihan had worked on. And Nixon told me, you know, get this around to everybody and leak it beforehand and make sure that it gets covered. So I was speaking to some reporter, and I said, hey, next week this will be this terrific speech, and you got to do it. Here's some of the things that will be in it. The FBI was listening to that reporter and said, aha, you see, there's a White House aide leaking. And so that triggered a tap on my phone for carrying out what the president asked me to do.
Hmm. You are a...
See, I was wrong about Watergate. I didn't think it would be a big deal. That's what's got me sensitized to abuses of power. And that's why today I'm interested in Iraqgate.
It strikes me that during this presidential campaign, people are just really tuned in to the campaign in a way that I can't remember happening before. And, you know, everybody watched the debates each night that they were on. And it's really become the national drama in a way I don't remember it being before. And I wonder if you feel that way, too. And if so, what you think explains it?
Well, it's a wonderful thing to see how all the political analysts and scientists who were bemoaning the fate of the republic, watching the participation go down to 50% in those eligible to vote actually voting. This year, they're predicting over 60%. We'll see what the actual result is, but they have registered more people, and the debates were stimulating and were watched by a pretty good audience. And I think that's part of the ebb and flow of American politics, and you can't really tell. I think we have an economic stagnation now, and we're irritated about it, and we want to do something about it, and that's what's got people riled up. And riled up about the president particularly, and willing to take a chance on change. Most of the time, people don't like to take a chance on change.
You have, you know, when you worked with the Nixon and Agnew administration, they were very outspoken in putting down the press. You're a member of the press now. I don't know if you wrote any of the lines particularly addressed to criticizing, you know, the press, but do you feel like the things that you used to criticize?
Well, I never criticize the press. I only criticize the media. There's a difference.
Oh yes. Shall we split hairs over that one?
Oh, listen, you're talking about my Dodge. I think, quite frankly, the media are criticizable. I construe that as plural. And the press is criticizable, particularly by the press and by the media. That's the best kind of criticism, when we zap each other for being a bunch of liberals or a bunch of hidebound conservatives, and it's a nice self-cleaning process. when politicians criticize us and use our lack of popularity, which is almost down as low as politicians, and appeal to people by saying that, you know, the damn media won't let me say this or won't cover me, that's a device. And we have to recognize it and let it, you know, let those peas roll off our life.
William Safire, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, Terry.
William Safire is the author of the new book, The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. He edited the new book, Lend Me Your Ears, Great Speeches in History.